Danielle Thomas, and welcome to the My Shit Therapist podcast. I hope you're well. I've got some nice news before we begin. This week, I worked with Amazon.co.uk on a panel about mental health for International Women's Day. I was joined by Laura Thomas, no relation, author of The Magic of Wellbeing, and Amanda Prowse, whose novels have sold millions of copies worldwide and have been translated into over 30 languages. Now, more recently, Amanda released her first autobiographical work, which she wrote with her son Josh about his struggle with mental illness. It's called The Boy Between, and I'm reading it at the moment. It's brilliant. Do check it out when you can. You can watch the panel for the whole of the month of March on amazon.co.uk/IWD, as in International Women's Day. So today's guest is Gemma Sherlock, a journalist from the Wirral in the Northwest and the co-host of not one but two mental health podcasts, No Really, I'm Fine, which I was a guest on a couple of years ago, and Mind Over Money, which is about financial well-being and the impact that money worries can have on our mental health. So that's where we started our chat. We went on to discuss her experience with panic attacks, depression, and suicidal ideation. Now, we also discuss what Gemma calls anticipatory grief, as her mother is currently receiving palliative care for terminal cancer. Now, as ever, if you're not feeling up to listening to it, do tap out now and come back to us another time. All right, let's get into it, shall we?
So the first one is about financial abuse. Obviously, domestic abuse has become, it's always been an issue, but it's become more prevalent and more worrying for people during the pandemic. So we felt it was really good to do a episode on, you know, targeted to that and helping people who are perhaps in a situation, an unfortunate situation, where they're not only suffering domestic abuse, but they're suffering financial abuse as well. And that can take many forms. For example, in the episode, we talk about how some people haven't even got a bank account, and we also talk to a charity called Safe Lives. So that's one episode. Another episode is about food poverty and food banks. Another one is about how to financially recover after lockdown if you've lost a job. I was able to bring those sorts of scenarios and how they impact on well-being and mental health, because, you know, lack of money is, you know, a big trigger for stress, anxiety and depression, really.
It's so important to make talking about money more accessible, because it's such a shameful thing, I think, when you feel like you're not managing your money, and that makes it more difficult to seek help. It just makes it worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, when I was younger, you know, some of my friends might have had a bit more money than me and were able to go out more for meals and things like that, and I always used to make up excuses that I wasn't feeling well, when in fact it was, I was skint, and I was just too ashamed to say that I can't afford it. But when you're that age, especially when you're a young teenager, there's that sense of social status in a group and wanting to be liked, and how that's linked to money is, it's quite upsetting when you think about it now, because now I'm just like, if my friend wants, not that we can go out now, but if we were to go out now, I'd be like, no, I'm skint, sorry, got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah. Sort of thing. So one thing that came to mind is when I graduated from uni, there was a scheme at the time called the Gerwood Bursary Fund, which I don't know whether or not it's still going, but it basically meant that if you got a 2-1 or a first, you were eligible for a bursary to get a job in an arts company. So I went to work for an opera company for a year in London. I was paid 15 grand for the whole year. That got me to London, and it was amazing. But I remember one time I went for lunch with the art director, and we were walking about around London Bridge, and my boss just went, oh, let's just go in here. And it was a cafe where the cheapest thing on the menu was a cheese and tomato sandwich, and it was £9.
Whoa. Get a full meal at Matthew's for that.
And I was skint, but I was with my boss, and I couldn't say, actually, I'm not going to get anything. I'm going to go somewhere else. I probably put that on my credit card. Like, I didn't have a credit card before I moved to London, and I had to get a credit card just to pay for my Oyster card, because I couldn't do that on my salary.
I mean, I think it's changing now, but you feel like all the big jobs are in London in terms of
yeah.
arts media. There's that sort of high expectation that you should be earning good money. If you to live in London, you need to earn good money.
I moved out of London because I was working in pubs and cafes because I wanted to focus on writing. And I thought, if I'm doing this, I can't live in London. So I moved over to Bristol, and then I started getting slightly more proper jobs. We're not going to know for a few years the impact that Corona is going to have on the city of London. Like, everyone's leaving because everyone's realizing that if you're not able to go out, why are you living in London?
Yeah, especially when I would rather be happy on a low income job and be surrounded by nature than in a big income job and be lonely.
Are you in Chester?
So I'm in the Wirral.
Okay. So I'm from North Wales, so not far away from you. I miss it, man. I didn't realise how much... I'm a city girl. Like, I get panicky if I don't see a Pret every 10 minutes. But I haven't been home in a year and a half.
Yeah.
And, I miss it. I miss the mountains.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's out the world, because you've got Liverpool over the water, so you've got best of both worlds sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's why when I went to Liverpool, John Moores Uni, and I stayed at home. But it was quite a shock because after uni, I got my first journalism job in Lancaster. So the day after graduation, and I moved up to Lancaster on my own, you know, the high street was probably about an eighth of Liverpool, and it was just so small and different, and it was just so scary. And but that's when my anxiety and depression did sort of come
really?
Up quite a bit when I moved there. Yeah, yeah.
You started feeling anxious and depressed after you graduated and after you moved to a smaller.
I think I've always had anxiety from an early age, but it was understanding what was going on once I moved to Lancaster, once I was on my own. Because it was a lot was going on in my life. My boyfriend at the time left me. He was supposed to move to Lancaster with me. I was 21. I've never paid a bill, didn't know what I was doing. I was in a flat. I was in a busy newspaper office and didn't know anyone, and everyone was married. There wasn't just like people who were a similar age for me. So it was quite difficult. I noticed I started having panic attacks. Never had one. I remember the first morning I had one, and I woke up and my chest was so tight and I couldn't breathe, and I thought I was having a heart attack. So I tried to reach for my phone to dial 999. And then I just could all of a sudden breathe again. So I hung up. And I immediately like sort of Googled my symptoms. And that's when I learned of what it was. And then I started having them frequently, like every couple of months, to the point where I had one in work and it was really embarrassing. Well, I felt really embarrassed. And then it sort of began from there. So I eventually seeked help from my GP in Lancaster, and she gave me a diagnosis of chronic anxiety and depression, because I sort of had a delayed reaction from moving away from my mum and dad, because I'm very close to my family, and also dealing with a bad breakup and starting a new job. It was very intense, and that sort of, I'm a type of person that just deals with stuff straight away and just goes in and goes, yes, I can do this, and then a month later I'm like, oh no, I can't what have I done, and sort of thing. So I was there for 4 years until I eventually, you know, I got a handle on my anxiety and depression. I was on citalopram.
Woo, same. High five.
Yeah, I'm on sertraline now, but I was on citalopram, and it was exhausting because I went through various CBT and counselling sessions on the NHS when I was in Lancaster. And that in itself, because Lancaster's so small, when we were in these group CBT sessions, you had to sign like a waiver, like a confidentiality waiver, to say that you won't tell anyone who's doing this. But I was like not to sound arrogant, that I was like a celebrity, but I felt like people like were looking at me because they knew I was from the newspaper, because we were such a small town. So going to the sessions was giving me anxiety, even though they probably didn't know who it was, but I still was thinking that in my mind. So that was just, did not help at all. And then it was just the case of going back on the waiting list for another 4 or 6 weeks to try and get solo on your own personal counselling sessions. So it was just an exhausting process. And through those various 4 years, I had an abusive relationship as well. So there was a lot going on. And then I eventually got back onto a different antidepressant, sertraline, because I felt like my symptoms had changed. I was no longer having panic attacks anymore. And then I moved home and moved back to the world in April 2018. And that was when I noticed a big difference in my mental health. But it changed a year later, and I can come on to that in terms of like my mum's diagnosis and stuff. But April 2018, I moved back and met the love of my life, Mark, who I'm with now, and we have a house together. So I think me being brave enough to move back home after having my career go so well in Lancaster, despite everything else that was going on, was probably a big step for me, and something that I'm still working on trying to recognize and be proud of myself for doing that sort of thing. But it's hard to sometimes be proud of yourself, isn't it? I'm aware I've rambled for a long time.
No, you haven't rambled. You've spoken really clearly and concisely about the podcast that you're here to do. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant podcast guest, and you're doing exactly what I have asked you to do.
It's very weird just being the guest, so I'm used to interviewing people rather than the other way around.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't like it.
So what happened? So when you moved back to the Wirral, were you still working for the newspaper in Lancaster, or were you able to get a different job?
I left there, and I had a job at a magazine in Wigan for a while, which was 2 months, because it was horrendous. I couldn't cope with the travel. And then I eventually got my dream job somewhere I've always wanted to work. I was at my mum and dad's for about a year, and then in that time I met Mark, and we got our house in January 2020 before. So we had 2 months before the pandemic, and then we spent lockdown in the pandemic, and we were saying, if we can get through lockdown, we can get through anything.
So were you still on sertraline at this point? And you're still on it now?
Yeah, I mean, I went up to 100 milligrams, and I'm down to 50 milligrams now. I still feel a sense of shame being on antidepressants, and it's really, I really frustrate myself, and it's really annoying that I still feel that way, because I don't know, I got into the state of mind because I had, before I met Mark, I had a suicidal episode. So that's when they put me on 100 milligrams of sertraline. And then I felt like I didn't need it, so they lowered me down again once I was starting to get better. But now I've been on 50 milligrams for so long, it's like, do I need to stay on it? Can I come off? And like, some of my friends have been on it and they've just come off cold turkey, which I know is really bad thing to do. But yeah, it's almost like it's obviously working if you feel like it's not working, if that makes sense. It's like,
well, if you don't notice it, yeah.
Yeah. So you're like, oh, I should come off then, shouldn't I? And then my doctor's like, no, let's just stay on it. So it's a bit of a weird relationship, isn't it, with antidepressants.
Yeah,
some people wanting to go down there.
Of, I think you can really easily fall into the trap of, do I need it, and do people need it, and is it just a scam by Big Pharma, and do I just need to go outside more and make some big lifestyle changes? I've been on citalopram for 7 years now, 6 or 7 years, and yeah, I'm constantly having that conversation of, yeah, but if I don't need them, I shouldn't be on them, as if it's a decision that I have to make, and if that's a bad thing, when it's not, it's just and it's just a thing that helps me. If it was something like insulin, if you could measure it in your blood or do a breathalyzer test and go, look, at this is the impact that it's having. But it's a lot more kind of amorphous and intangible than that. And that's something that I've wound myself up about a lot. But now I try really hard to just go, stop it. Like, that's not a decision that you have to make right now. That's not a today problem. You're not single-handedly holding up the pharma industry and contributing to worldwide terribleness with your daily 20 milligrams of citalopram. That's not my fight, really.
Yeah.
So it's hard not to get kind of big picture about it. But all I can do is stay well for myself. If you just like reduce it to its most like pertinent and honest thing, you just go, right, do I need this to feel well at the moment today? Yes. All right. So just take it with your iron supplements.
Those feelings come up more as well, though, when you're paying £10 a month for them. It's like, why aren't they free? Why am I paying money for my brain?
Can I ask you about you said it was a suicidal episode?
Yeah, I had a couple in Lancaster. The first one I had, it wasn't so much I was harming myself or going to do something. It was... I was in the bath and I remember thinking, I'm just fed up of worrying all the time. I'm fed up with this. I can't do this anymore. So shall I just go and take a little tablet so I can just have a big sleep? It wasn't like, I want to go and kill myself. But that was sort of a thought that came into my mind for about 5 seconds and it absolutely terrified me. Mm. So doctors always ask you, don't they, like, have you ever acted on those thoughts? And I just say no. I keep having them though, they are frightening me. So that was when they changed me to sertraline. So when I came back home, it was a big shock for me because to have another one, because I was like, well, I'm back home now with my mum and dad, everything's going to be fine and everything's just going to go away. And it didn't. And I remember sitting on the back doorstep in the rain, holding my favourite Alice in Wonderland cup with half a bit of tea in, and I was just sitting there like staring. I was full of anger and I wanted to just go and drive to a motorway bridge and just see how brave I was. So that it wasn't like I want to go and kill myself again, but it was sort of linked. And my dad came out and he was like, come in, what are you doing? And he didn't really realise how bad it was until I threw my cup on the floor, smashed my cup, and it just broke down. And that's when I told my dad, and it's a hard thing to tell your dad, I want to do this. And obviously that upset him. That was the last one, sorry, I didn't mention. I had another one when I was at home as well, where my anxiety was so bad one night. My dad he still does. My dad takes Kaya the dog out every evening at 11. And I used to get quite scared about something that's going to happen to my dad all the time. And I think it's more to do with the fact that as a news reporter, you're constantly writing horrible stories. So that's played on my mental health a lot, writing crime stories and things like that. So I always used to worry that that was going to happen to my dad. I don't help myself, by the way, because I love loads of documentaries about serial killers.
I know.
Anyway, I remember him going out and I wasn't asleep, but I got out of bed and I was proper sweating, frantically pacing the room. And I was like, something's going to happen to dad. And then it was like my brain was having an argument with itself. I don't know how to explain it, but I just couldn't cope. And I went downstairs into the kitchen to try and find Liz paracetamol. And that's when my dad started opening the back door to come back in. And then everything just went away and I went back upstairs to bed. So it's like those suicidal tendencies have really, I've not had one in a while. Well, I've not had one since my mum was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in August 2019. So
sorry, love.
Okay, that sounds like it sounds horrible to say, I've never known like found the right words, but my mum's terminal illness has saved me, if that makes sense. So like, because you feel guilty about wanting to harm yourself anyway, or you know, feel guilty about having those thoughts anyway. So when my mum's choice of life was taken away, I suddenly realized I shouldn't be doing this to anyone, and I felt really selfish. So since then, it's just my mental health sort of changed in terms of I'm sort of going through anticipatory grief at the moment because my mum's got about 6 months to live. Sorry.
It's all right. Take your time. You can stop anytime.
Yes, all right. So in August 2019, basically what happened, my mum and dad went on holiday in May to Tenerife, and I remember mum coming back and she was just constantly being sick. She couldn't seem to eat properly. So she went to hospital and they just couldn't decipher what was going on. And because mum would be like, well, I've just had a McDonald's. The doctors would be like, well, if you've got an upset stomach. And she's like, I know, but I'm really hungry. So she was in and out of hospital. And then they came across a sort of weird circle on a pancreas. And then that's when they discovered it was a tumour. So from then they tried to operate, but she was past the stage of surgery, unfortunately. So I think I've talked about it in my blog, and I do talk about it on the podcast, like, and it'll be always be a memory in my mind of me holding my dad's hand, walking to the room where they tell us that they can't do anything for mum. And it was horrible because I was just like, I sort of knew what was going on because there was a nurse with the surgeon, and I was like, I don't want this conversation. So that was in August 2019, but then things sort of got better because, you know, mum went on chemo. She lost all her hair, but, you know, we were both really strong together, and I went with her to go and get a wig, and it was really good, and she could still do stuff. And then can I swear, by the way?
Yeah, of course. It's called my shit therapist.
Yeah. And the pandemic hit, and we were like, oh, well, this is a crock of shit. When was it? She got really poorly at the end of last year, to the point where she was, I think from September, she couldn't seem to have the strength to go to chemo anymore. So that was quite a worry, because she would have 3 weeks of chemo and then a week off. And then like in December, from Christmas Day, she didn't eat she's not eaten basically from Christmas Day. And that's because, so she went into hospital on the 19th of January this year. And I can't remember what the disease is called, but basically she now has a disease of the stomach lining, and it's not curable, and it's quite a common side effect from pancreatic cancer. The cancer's spread now into her bowels and stomach. And since then she's at home now, but she's basically in palliative care. And I had a big breakdown last night because I was just like, I don't know if I can do this podcast, but I think once I have a cry, I'm fine. But it's just like, she rang me last night and like, she's so dosed up and it's not my mum anymore. It's just really hard to like watch your mum die in front of you. So I'm just, like, everyone keeps saying, oh, you're doing so well and you're doing strong. And it's just like, well, I respect what you're saying and I appreciate it, but you don't really know, like, no one really understands. And like, my mum's only bloody 53. So it's just difficult to sort of have a mental illness whilst also watching your mum just leave your life. But it's almost like I don't really have anxiety anymore. Everything's just sort of focused on my mum. So I can't really feel my own emotions, if that makes sense. But I still have my therapist and she's great. I eventually found her last year, and I do pay for her, and I know not everyone has that privilege, but I just thought I need to look after myself because I need extra support and I can't cope with me and my mom. I just can't do it. So she's been brilliant and been really helpful, and just like she got me through before mum got really poorly, sort of accepting that my mum is going to die, which is sort of, you know, having that, those skills, if you like, those emotional skills to sort of comprehend what's going on. So she's been great, and I see her every month, and when people ask me how I get through stuff, that's probably the reason. And Mark and my dog. So yeah, there we go, another big ramble for you, Michelle. But I don't like talking about it, because, well, I do, but not to people I've not met before, because or even like Mark's family, because I just hate making people feel uncomfortable. And I don't want that. And I'm not expecting people to, you know, say, oh, it'll be okay, or it'll be fine. I'm not expecting an answer from them. Sometimes it's just good to talk, but then I feel awful because I don't want to upset people. So it's just like, I'll just stay quiet. And then, yeah, but because Mark used to say to me when it first happened, oh, I don't know what to say. And it's just like, you don't need to say anything. Just be there for me, and it's going to be a shit time. So, but there's nothing you can do, is there? There's nothing I can do. And in a weird way, it's sort of helped my anxiety, because it's something that's totally out of my control, and I've always tried to control things. So it's sort of coping with that and sort of realizing, well, life's shit and there's nothing I can do, and other people have probably gone through the same thing as me and they're still here, and I can do this.
Thank you so much.
What's the best and worst thing a therapist has ever said to you, or a mental health professional?
I mean, I hate the phrase chin up. Some of my family have said that before.
Chin up, Charlie.
Things like, they've said to me, oh, have you tried taking a bath? You know, stuff like that. And it's just like,
no, I live in a cave.
Well, bath doesn't solve everything. I don't want to sit in a bath. Go like a prune. I get like people go, you know, baths are good for well-being. And it's like, yeah, but that's not the answer to everything. I'm not like, you know, have a bath, you put a face mask on, and I'll forget about my problems.
I love that. Suicidal ideation, just have a bath.
Have a bath, yeah.
And especially because you said that the first time you experienced a thought like that was when you were in the bath.
Yeah.
In a way,
yeah.
In your case, baths cause mental illness. If we just crack this wide open.
Yeah, that's actually true. Because last week I was in the bath and I had a big whinge about my mum. But sometimes you need that. Sometimes you need to have that. You need to let the vulnerability of your mind just be open for a moment. But yeah, no, in the past, baths have not been great. And another thing as well, I've just remembered, on the NHS ones, you used to get given all this homework to do at home, of CBT sort of coursework. And they're like, now I don't want to overwhelm you, but here's like 15 booklets to go away and read. It's like, no, hold on, I've come here to do this now. I don't want to go home and do it. So that's probably another situation. Yeah. I don't want to overwhelm you.
Don't
maybe
overwhelm you.
But.
And what's the best thing a therapist has said to you? You're seeing a therapist now who's really, really good.
Yes. One that springs to mind straight away is, it's okay to cry. Because I've always tried to not cry, even though I cry a lot, but I don't like other people seeing me cry. And Liz, her name is, she's lovely. She's just said it's okay to cry, and it's okay to take time for yourself. For example, it was my birthday on Monday, and I said to Liz, oh, I'm gonna spend all day with my mum. And Liz was like, I don't think that's a good idea. And I was like, why? And she was like, well, your mum's bedbound, she's in the front room. Would she really want her daughter to spend the whole day with her? No. It's just like, that's true. She's like, why don't you just go and see her for a couple of hours and then do what you do what you want to do on your birthday. So I did do that, and it helps. It's more take time for yourself has been quite a big one for me.
You can follow Gemma Sherlock on Twitter. Gemma is currently raising money for Cancer Research UK. I'll pop her fundraising page in the episode description notes. Thank you so much for listening, and as ever, take care and take your meds. Bye-bye.